Thank you very much. I'm going to try and remember that it's a hybrid meeting. I think it's very easy to forget and end up only speaking to people in the room. So I'll try and keep my voice up. If it seems that I'm shouting, don't think it's because I'm angry. I mean, well, I may be angry, but that won't be the reason I'm shouting. Okay. Section one, the title. Marxism and Marx, can they ever be friends? You can imagine somebody being really annoyed by this title and saying, what kind of a daft question is this? I mean, we know who Marx is. We know that it's Karl. It's a 19th century German who wrote loads of stuff and was politically active. It's not Groucho, it's not Harpo, it's Karl. We know that. Correspondingly, Marxists will be people who come reasonably close in word or in deed to Marx himself. Why on earth think there's any kind of problem about this that needs a talk? And why on earth should we think that there's ever going to be any tension between Marx on the one hand and people who think and act like him on the other? Well, my answer to that really is that things are not quite that simple. For one thing, Marx left behind more words than any other thinker in the history of the Western world. Now, it would be impossible to do that without at some point managing to contradict yourself. And that means that there's sometimes an issue about deciding just what Marx's stance is on a particular problem. And it makes it a complicated matter to identify Marx's own views. Sometimes we just have to recognise the contradictions and make some judgment about which of these contradictory views most represents Marx's own position. And by the same token, it's quite a tricky business to decide whether some position which is called Marxist does adequately reflect the views of this individual. And also, as far as this goes, we should remember that the label Marxism is not always a self-description. Sometimes it's an accusation. Now, I'll give you an example of this. I don't know how many of you will know a website called Guido Fawkes, Fawkes as in Guy Fawkes. It's a home for rabid right-wingers. I quite often make myself watch it in order to remind myself what I'm up against in trying to change people's political consciousness. And on this website, more than once, I've seen the complaint that Boris Johnson is a Marxist. Now, if that does anything, it surely emphasises that any credentials for being a Marxist need to be inspected and not just taken for granted. And then finally, someone might argue for the distance between Marx and Marxism by appeal to the fact that Marx himself is alleged to say, to alleged not to be himself a Marxist. That's an issue. I maybe go into that a bit more in the discussion if people want me to. But the allegation is Marx said, as for me, I am not a Marxist. Okay, so that's the title defended, or as much of a defence as it's going to get. I want to suggest there are at least three cases where there's a good reason for saying that Marx cannot be friends with people who identify as Marxists or are identified as Marxists. Three clear examples of Marx and Marxism coming apart. And I label these political activism, Western or structural Marxism, and analytical Marxism. So section two, political activism. Now, I said that Marx is bound to have contradicted himself, given the immense volume of his writings. One issue on which he does not contradict himself is the question of democracy. He's unequivocally in favour of it. Indeed, he says that the first step in the revolution by the working class is to raise the proletariat to the position of ruling class to win the battle of democracy. Therefore, he supports the Chartist movement in its work to secure universal suffrage, at least for men. And he also ensures that the rules of the First International, the International Working Men's Association, contain the proviso that the emancipation of the working class has to be the work of the working class itself. And not only that, but he also recognises that democracy as it existed at that time, parliamentary democracy, was itself flawed and partial. He says the parliamentary regime leaves everything to the decision of majorities. And he asks rhetorically, why then should the great majority outside parliament not want to make the decisions? So in other words, he's recognising the deficiencies in democracy in the form which it exists and proposing an extension of it. Now, Marx's commitment to democracy is there for all to see. And it's in keeping with the idea that socialism itself is a democratic form of society where people voluntarily cooperate in running, and the preparation which equips them to do so is the formation of a political party to work for that goal. That's all plain from Marx's text. And I mean, here's the strange thing. Marx's commitment to democracy must be one of the best-kept secrets of the 20th century. Overwhelmingly, his name came to be associated with, not with democracy, but with tyranny and violence. Millions of people think that's his view. Why? Well, we can answer that question in one word or one name, and the name is Lenin. Marx's view is that the movement for socialism is the self-conscious, independent movement of the immense majority. Lenin's view is that the workers are capable of reaching they are not capable of reaching revolutionary consciousness by their own efforts. It has to be brought to them from without. And that a vanguard should seize power. Now, there is a gulf between these views, but that gulf didn't prevent the birth of Marxism-Leninism, a politics which implied that Marx's position and Lenin's position were complementary rather than incompatible with each other. And that's why Marx's name came to be associated with the brutal and oppressive regimes born of that politics. It thus became possible for millions of people to say that Marx's ideas had been tried out and that they didn't work. So, can Marx and Marxism-Leninism ever be friends? Well, I think the conclusion is inescapable, that with a friend like Lenin, Marx didn't need any enemies. Now, let me step back slightly at this point. What I've been talking about is the different forms that political activism should take. I also want to finger a couple of movements which claim the name Marxist, which I think is dubious. And these are theoretical movements. So section three of my talk is, why do we need theory? After all, as we know, the philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. Okay, if the point is to change the world, why get bogged down in all these words? Why not just get on with it? I think the answer to that is that if you're to change the world in an effective way, you need to know what you're doing. You don't just open the front door and look out and say, oh, look, there's capitalism. It takes an effort and it takes some theories to make sense of what you see when you open the front door. I once went to a concert where there was a really posh cocktail bar pianist. And he was deploring the state of the modern world and how nobody knows their place anymore. And he came out with an unforgettable line. He said, at least in the 1950s, if a man wore denim, one knew he was a plumber. Now, maybe this cocktail pianist had a point, not the point he wanted, perhaps. I mean, maybe there was a time when you could determine someone's class position by the way they dressed, top hat and tails or rags. But that time has undoubtedly gone. This is the point you may not want, but it's the point which I think is correct. that time has gone, if it ever did exist. I'm sure Elon Musk wears denim, and he probably pokes holes in the knees to show that he's down with the kids. So we have to look beyond these surface appearances to determine class position. We have to have some kind of theory. Well, Marx, as we know, provides theories in abundance on all those questions of class which are implicit in this example. Also theories about the role of materiality in history, the dynamics of historical change, the structure of capitalism, and so on. Now, these theories are many, and they're complex, and they're contentious. And it would be potentially a lifetime job to decide whether someone calling himself Marxist shares enough common ground at a theoretical level to justify taking his name. However, rather than looking at particular theories of Marx and seeing how far different Marxists can coincide or diverge with him, what we can do is we can start by identifying the style of Marx's commitment to theory, and then to ask how near or far from this some Marxists are. Style is a word I'm not happy about entirely, because it's a suggestion of fashions or fads or surface appearances, and there's something much more important than that to be asked about this. And it's perhaps best illustrated by saying what type of theorising Marx does go in for. And what I think shines through in all his work is a commitment to argumentation and evidence rather than just wishful thinking or arm-waving. Marx assembles arguments, facts, and statistics to try and establish his claims. And it's reasonable to ask anyone wanting to take his name that they should proceed in the same kind of way. At which point I move to section 4, Western or structural Marxism. Now, a leading figure in this theoretical movement was a French Leninist philosopher, or perhaps more accurately say Stalinist philosopher, called Louis Althusser. Please don't ask me how to spell his name, because in 5 minutes' time you're going to wish you'd never heard it. Althusser wrote a book called Reading Capital, which is about reading Marx's book Capital. And he says, and I quote, "A philosophical reading of Capital is quite the opposite of an innocent reading. It is a guilty reading, but not one that absolves its crime on confessing it. On the contrary, it takes the responsibility for its crime as a justified crime and defends it by providing its necessity. It is, therefore, a special reading which exculpates itself as a reading by posing every guilty reading the very question that unmasks its innocence, the mere question of its innocence, what is it to read?" I am not making this up. Here is a comment that Althusser makes about dialectics. He says, "Marx's dialectics would have been very relevant to us today, since it would have been the theory of Marx's theoretical practice. That is exactly a determinant theoretical form of the solution that exists in the practical state to the problem we are dealing with, the problem of the specificity of the Marxist dialectic." Well, what do you think? Bear in mind, what we're talking about here is theories which are supposed to get people to see the world in a certain way and to galvanize them into action to change that world. What kind of the utterance has the greater potential to do that? The kind of utterances I've just quoted, or "workers of the world unite, you have a whole world to win, you have nothing to lose but your chains"? I would say there's no contest. Theory of the Althusser kind is pure gobbledygook. It can do nothing to encourage an understanding of the world we live in or a determination to change it. Ask yourself if there's even any way of bringing forward evidence either for or against the claims made in these quotes. If there's nothing which would incline us one way or the other, then the claims are just meaningless. And I think that to call stuff like this Marxist is an insult to Marx. Now, someone might say, well, yeah, isn't it a bit unfair to single out this guy when many other thinkers could be mentioned who maybe don't have the same degree of bombast or obscurantism? But the answer to that is that Althusser has been extremely influential. And he's had this impact in the world, which is important to neutralise. And he is a leading figure. He has the distinction of having been mentioned in a question on University Challenge. You can't get much more serious than that. Section 5, Analytical Marxism. This is an utterly distinct theoretical position. And it originates with a book by a Canadian philosopher called Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen, who wrote a book called Karl Marx's Theory of History, A Defense. And in the main part of that book, Cohen takes the idea that what's basic in the history of us as a species is growth in productive power, growth, development of all the things that we need to survive. And it's the form that the growth in productive power takes that marks different forms of human society, different sets of relations between people, depending on the kind of technology that they had to work with, and so on. And there's elaborate and painstaking discussion of all the terms involved in these theories. And attributions of any view to Marx are supported by detailed reference to his works. The analytical Marxism, which Cohen's book inaugurated, is a movement which involves going back to Marx's texts and examining them with the rigor characteristic of analytical philosophy. Many debates about Marx's theories were initiated in this way by analytical Marxism, and many still continue today. I should mention that the proponents of analytical Marxism sometimes refer to their standpoint as non-bullshit Marxism. And having had a look at the views of Professor Althusser a few moments ago, you can perhaps see why they do that. So, that all sounds fairly good. Have we at last found a form of Marxism that Marx could be friends with? Well, I hate to disappoint you. Earlier on, I suggested beginning by looking at the style of Marxist theorising rather than the content of particular theories. And in that respect, it's hard to think of any more appropriate form of discussion than the one favoured by analytical Marxists. It's exactly, I mean, they're doing what Marx did, producing facts, figures, putting theories around them to try and get at the truth about how the world is, how we can change it, what we have to do to get there. That's all well and good, but it's just not possible to stave off indefinitely the question of agreement or disagreement on a whole range of particular issues. And for example, Cohen implicitly regards Russia as a non-capitalist form of society. He believes that the broad middle classes are an important component in the structure of capitalist society. And he believes that the Marxist tradition expects revolution only in times of crisis. Now, all of these views can be challenged. And the question then has to be raised whether there's sufficient agreement about Marxist theories elsewhere to justify associating Marx and analytical Marxism in this way. I want to take a step back again now, section 6 of my talk. There's something about Charlie. Now, what is it about Marx's theories that explains why we're still talking about them in the second century after he was alive? People still want to appropriate his name or hurl it as an accusation at other people. What has made Marx so durable? Well, I think the answer lies in what he chooses to talk about and how he chooses to talk about it. And what he chooses to talk about is our materiality, We're material creatures with material needs, food, clothing, shelter, and so on. And they have to be met not once, but over and over again, as the price to pay for being alive as a human being at all. And so it should be of the greatest interest to us how, in our particular historical epoch, we have to act to satisfy those material needs and the massive implications this has for the kind of life that we can lead. And Marx chooses to talk about our materiality at a fairly general and abstract level. He focuses on the basic dynamic of capitalism, the sale and purchase of labour power. So, either you belong to the 90-odd percent of people who have to sell their labour power to meet their needs, or you belong to the lucky few who purchase the labour power and in consequence can make themselves extremely rich and choose any life they like. So, do you own the means of producing wealth or not? Do you hire other people to develop them? Or do you have to sell your ability to work to have any access to this wealth? These are the considerations that Marx urges us to look at. Forget about top hat and tails and rags, and look at these more general properties. Well, I think this move to a more general and abstract level helps to explain why Marx's ideas have been so durable. Capitalism has taken many forms, some of which I think Marx couldn't probably have foreseen. But that basic dynamic of sale and purchase of labour power is present throughout. Marx goes right to the heart of capitalism. And that's enabled his position to survive lots of changes in different forms of society, different forms of capitalism. We've had industrial capitalism, state capitalism, welfare state capitalism, democratic capitalism, fascist capitalism, any number of different forms which that society can take, but they are all based on that fundamental issue of the sale and purchase of labour power. So Marx addresses what's omnipresent in any form of capitalism, and since capitalism is still with us, his theories remain of interest after all this time. And yet, paradoxically, this attention to the abiding features of capitalism is not necessarily what people have focused on. Rather, there's been a lot of emphasis on this or that aspect of capitalism, and not necessarily, in their hands, even its material features necessarily. So I think this move to what I've called a general abstract level also explains why there's an issue about Marx's relation to Marxism. Marx opposes capitalism as such, but there are people who expect him to be their friend, who only attack this or that form of capitalism, people whose theories therefore don't have the scope or the depth which his do. And we've seen the political fallout from that over the last 150 years. This or that aspect of capitalism has been taken in isolation, it's been attacked, and none of the major problems of capitalism have been eradicated. Poverty, insecurity, wars, antisocial crime, and so on, they all remain. I'm struck by an observation that George Orwell made once. He says somewhere that we sometimes have to decide whether a word is worth saving or whether it's been so debased, it's been so ill-abused that we might as well just drop it altogether. Now, Marxism is a good case in point for the argument that Orwell is making there, as indeed is the word socialism. The Socialist Party exists as an organisation to raise political consciousness amongst working people. In our 120 years of existence, no one could claim that we've been a roaring success in achieving that. And it may be that the vocabulary we use is one factor in this lack of success. Maybe the vocabulary needs to be completely revised, given the hugely mistaken assumptions which has picked up in the course of its history. Now, I'm not going to try and answer this question, whether certain terms should just be dropped, partly because I believe Howard's going to deal with it in his talk, and he's going to give us a definitive answer to all the problems, so I don't want to get in the way of that. So no pressure there, Howard. But I will enter a word of caution in how to handle this matter. I understand that in the course of the party's history, there was a suggestion that its name should be changed because of the associations of the term Great Britain. The nationalistic associations, which meant that we ran the risk of being seen as some kind of nationalistic or fascist organisation. And because the aim of the party was to produce a society where all wealth is held in common, some party members suggested that we should re-describe ourselves again as the Commonwealth Party. Now, that would have been fine until the British Empire decided to change its name to the British Commonwealth. And at that point, the misleading associations of one term just get replaced by the misleading associations of another term. So I think the moral is, if you decide to change vocabulary, don't imagine you can do this once and for all. Okay, section 7, concluding speculative question. What would Marx be saying and doing if he were alive today? Well, here are my suggestions. He would be saying to most of the people who invoke his name, come on, guys, enough is enough. Capitalism is the problem. That's what we need to address. Not just this or that aspect of capitalism, not the suffering arising from this or that position within capitalist system, but the whole system itself and the dreadful effects that has on human beings. What he would be doing is ringing the bell at 52 Clapham High Street and asking for a Form A to fill in to join the party. And he'd say, I'd like to join and try to help with the task of raising socialist consciousness. That's a pressing necessity because of the many dangers that capitalism threatens to visit on our species. Even if we only look at environmental threats, we might burn ourselves to death, we might starve ourselves, we might blow ourselves up and drown in our own shit. These dangers can't be addressed piecemeal, nor is their alleviation compatible with the imperatives of commodity society. And he would say, because he was an honest person, I own up to dabbling with reformism myself in the past, but those days, they're now gone. We have to abolish capitalism before capitalism abolishes us. So that's what Marx will be doing. He'd be legging it down to Clapham to apply to join the party. Of course, whether he would be admitted to the party, another question altogether. I won't enter into that. I want to ruin the start of a beautiful friendship. Thank you.